This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yais Wuhib. Coming up on Africa News Tonight,
I call upon all of us to set aside our differences, to seek out common ground, and to summon the unity we need to deliver for the people. This is really the key.
That's U.S. President Donald Trump speaking last night at his first State of the Union address. We'll have more on the nationally televised speech before Congress coming up.
Also, Uganda has become the home for 1 million refugees from neighboring South Sudan, where a civil war is moving into its fifth year. And the multinational joint task force fighting Boko Haram continues to free hostages from the terrorist strongholds.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on African News Tonight.
Our top story, Kenya's interior minister warns that arrest may be in store in relation to opposition leader Raila Odinga's self-inauguration ceremony yesterday as the people's president. Meanwhile, authorities say local media stations prevented from broadcasting yesterday's event live will remain off the air pending the results of an investigation. Mohammed Yusuf reports from Nairobi.
Interior Minister Fred Matiang'i says Raila Odinga's inauguration was, in his words, a well-choreographed attempt to subvert or overthrow the government.
We have commenced a wide-scale investigation targeting individuals and organizations who include but may not be limited to certain media houses. We will act decisively but strictly according to the law.
On Tuesday, before thousands of supporters gathered at a Nairobi public park, Odinga took a symbolic oath of office as a so-called People's President, an act the government has termed illegal and potentially amounting to treason. Following the Interior Minister's press conference Wednesday, local media were already reporting at least one arrest. A lawyer and opposition MP who stood prominently on stage with Odinga Tuesday administering the oath. Legal analysts tell VOA it may be difficult for authorities to arrest Odinga, as in the ceremony he did not claim the title of President of the Republic of Kenya. His Twitter account currently identifies him as simply His Excellency. Kenyan lawyer and former chairman of the East Africa Law Society, James Mwamu, says Tuesday's oath by the opposition National Super Alliance, or NASA, carried no legal weight.
Going on forward, however, I think what NASA is intending to do is to rather legitimize this by passing the People's Assembly. So at the end of the day, when the People's Assembly will resolve that this is the way they want to go, then at that particular point, it will obtain some legal meaning. But for now, I think we can safely say in terms of legal interpretation, there is absolutely no effect about the swearing.
NASA is Odinga's opposition coalition. After an October rerun of the August presidential election, Odinga then created the National Resistance Movement, or NRM. Kenyan authorities accused the NRM of planning to incite large-scale violence Tuesday. The Interior Minister cited that accusation as the ground upon which the government cut transmission Tuesday for four local TV and radio outlets that had planned to broadcast Odinga swearing in live. Odinga boycotted the rerun of the presidential election and has refused to accept President Uhuru Kenyatta's victory, which was certified by the Kenyan Supreme Court. In a sign of the continued political tensions, an identified gunman attacked the home of Deputy Opposition Leader Kalonzo Musyoka with a grenade Tuesday night. Police spokesman Charles Owino says an investigation has been opened.
Fortunately, the hand grenade that exploded is a stun hand grenade. So a stun hand grenade is a grenade that gives you a very loud bang. It is meant to scare. It's not meant to harm or to kill.
More than 3 months after the controversial presidential revote, Kenya's political scene certainly shows no sign of cooling down. Mohammed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
U.S. President Donald Trump delivered a message of unity and progress yesterday evening during his first State of the Union speech before a joint session of Congress. VOA White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman reports that during the address, Trump took credit for a booming U.S. economy, requested $1.5 trillion for infrastructure improvements, and proposed that young people brought illegally to the United States be given a 12-year path to citizenship.
President Trump stuck to the script, touting his administration's accomplishments and talking tough about threats from abroad.
Around the world, we face rogue regimes, terrorist groups, and rivals like China and Russia that challenge our interests, our economy, and our values. In confronting these horrible dangers, we know that weakness is the surest path to conflict. And unmatched power is the surest means to our true and great defense.
North Korea, which is trying to build nuclear-tipped missiles capable of reaching America and its allies, was singled out for criticism, Trump saying its regime has a depraved character. The president made an appeal for domestic political harmony, to modernize transportation infrastructure, and reform immigration policies.
Tonight, I call upon all of us to set aside our differences, to seek out common ground, and to summon the unity we need to deliver for the people. This is really the key.
A record number of opposition lawmakers boycotted the president's speech. Members of the Congressional Black Caucus wore kente cloth as a rejoinder to Trump's recent disparaging remarks about African countries. In the Democrats' official response, Trump's name was never mentioned by the congressman whose grandfather's brother was among America's most famous 20th century presidents.
Bullies may land a punch. They may leave a mark. But they have never, not once, in the history of our United States, managed to match the strength and spirit of a people united in defense of their future.
In a country deeply polarized about the 45th president, this one presidential address is unlikely to sway a significant percentage of voters.
I think his base heard a lot of things in that speech they're going to like, but generally my guess is it's going to fall flat with the broader public. I mean, it was a long, more than an hour and 20 minutes, and there weren't really developed ideas for how to move forward. It really was sort of a laundry list of ideas, but without a lot of specific substance.
Despite the president's call for unity and declaring his first year as president a great success, storm clouds loom on the horizon. A special counsel continues to investigate the Trump campaign's contacts with Russian operatives during the 2016 election season and whether the president himself in office obstructed justice. Steve Herman, VOA News, Washington.
Uganda is home to more than 1 million refugees from neighboring South Sudan, where a civil war is moving into its fifth year. Visiting northern Uganda this week, the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, Filippo Grande, appealed to leaders in South Sudan to make peace. Halima Athmani reports from the Arua district of northern Uganda.
The ratio of South Sudanese refugees to local residents in the Arua district is now 1-4, according to the UNHCR. That puts nearly a quarter million refugees in that district alone. At the vast Invepi settlement, a 23-year-old refugee named Susan digs the foundation for her new home using her bare hands and a metal bar. Her baby cries nearby. Susan has had to dig 16 holes, each 60 centimeters long, in which to insert the logs.
But the problem of house is problem for me. The stone is better more. This one I suffer. Nobody to help me.
UN High Commissioner for Refugees, Filippo Grandi, visited the settlement Tuesday. Talking to new arrivals like Susan, she told of how her brother was killed by rebels, leaving her to care for his three children in addition to her own. Grandi made this appeal to the warring factions in South Sudan.
Please make peace. We can't subject these people once again to exile, to suffering. We can't always take for granted the generosity of the Ugandan people. Really, we must ensure that peace comes, because everybody told me this morning, as in the past, if there is peace, I will go back, because this is where I belong. It's my country.
Uganda is currently hosting 1.3 million refugees, nearly all of them from South Sudan. The civil war started in 2013 and a 2015 peace deal quickly disintegrated. International monitors say a ceasefire signed in December was also violated in short order. 19-year-old Serena Alex lives at Invepi Settlement. She has no word on her seven family members since she fled her hometown of Yei.
So many people are losing life in South Sudan. Brothers and sisters, mothers and our fathers, they are losing life in South Sudan because of the war. But I requested the president of South Sudan that they could cool down and bring peace to South Sudan.
Grandi's visit to Uganda comes ahead of a fresh funding appeal to be announced Thursday to meet the needs of more than 2.2 million displaced South Sudanese in 2018. Many of the displaced are children. Halima Athmani for VOA News, Arua, Uganda.
The multinational joint task force fighting Boko Haram continues to free hostages from the terrorist strongholds. But the struggles of the newly liberated are far from over. Moki Edwin Kenzaka reports from Zamai in northern Cameroon.
Four army jeeps of the multinational joint task force fighting the Boko Haram insurgency have just arrived at Zamai, a northern Cameroon village that borders Nigeria. 16 rescued Boko Haram hostages are in the vehicles, including 39-year-old Lamine Mamoudou.
Les gens de Boko Haram sont venus à Gouzdavreket.
He says they were kidnapped 2 years ago from Cameroon's border village of Ngulavekel and taken to a place called Chenene in Nigeria, where they were tortured, denied food, money and water. He says many hostages became sick because of poor hygiene and lack of food and were killed. He says Christians and animists who refused to convert to Islam were also killed. Mamoudou was freed January 26th during an operation carried out by the Cameroonian military. His group joined hundreds of other former hostages living in two camps at Zamai. Astafu Hamadou escaped a Boko Haram camp in Nigeria along with 30 other women. Hamadou says the Boko Haram fighters would beat any woman found outside a camp. But then the women noticed the fighters were not coming to their camps regularly anymore. She says they decided to escape after many of the women developed rashes all over their bodies from being forced to bathe in dirty stream waters. She said seven of the women in her group did not make it to Zamai. She does not know what happened to them. The former hostages want to return to their villages. But the most senior Cameroon government official in the area, Julien Martial Asse, says they are very cautious about granting these individuals complete freedom.
On les appelle dans notre jargon les présumés ex-otages de Boko Haram.
He says although the government has some level of confidence in the people they receive, officials prefer calling them presumed ex-hostages of Boko Haram because of surging insecurity in host villages. He says the more they kept the former hostages in border villages, the more the villages were attacked by Boko Haram fighters, so there are plans to transport them to the hinterlands in Cameroon. The number of men, women and children abducted by Boko Haram during the terror group's 8-year insurgency is not known, but is believed to be well into the thousands. Men and boys report having been conscripted to fight or serve as porters, while women and girls report forced marriages and slave labor in the terrorist camps. Boko Haram has been fighting to establish a strict Islamic state in northern Nigeria. A regional military offensive since 2015 has retaken much of the territory Boko Haram once controlled. Rescued hostages have presented a challenge. Communities in Cameroon have been wary of them, in particular amid a surge in suicide bombings along the border in the past year. There are also fears more returnees mean more mouths to feed, straining already overstretched resources. The traditional ruler of Zamai, Ibrahim Hamawa, says he's negotiating with his people to allocate some portions of their farmlands to the former hostages when the next planting season begins.
S'ils seront là jusqu'à la saison pluvieuse, nous allons leur préparer des champs.
He says if the ex-hostages are going to be staying in their village for a long time, they will need to give them land to cultivate food. And more continue to arrive. There were 400 former hostages in Zamai's camps in December. 1 month later, the number has grown to at least 600. Moki Edwin Kinzika for VOA News, Zamai, Northern Cameroon.
20 minutes past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Egypt's President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi today warned opposition members who are calling for a boycott of coming presidential elections. In a speech, Sisi said he would not permit that anyone plays with the country's security. He also said that what happened 7 or 8 years ago will not be repeated, an apparent reference to the Arab Spring Rising 7 years ago that ousted former President Hosni Mubarak. In 2013, Sisi led a coup that forced out President Mohamed Morsi, who was elected after Mubarak's departure. Several opposition groups yesterday said they are organizing a boycott of the March elections, calling them a charade. Since becoming elected president in 2014, Sisi has cracked down on opposition politicians and media critics. Hundreds of dissidents have been jailed. His only opposition in the election is a man who leads a political party that endorsed Sisi's candidacy. Critics say the government has coerced other candidates to drop out.
The Egyptian president's warning against opposition plans to boycott national elections comes just 7 years after a popular uprising ousted autocratic president Hosni Mubarak. Regional political analysts say it appears the once rising hope for democracy in Egypt has been crushed. VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawi has more.
Initially, the popular uprising in January of 2011 succeeded in forcing former Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak to quit and democratic elections were held. But the elected civilian President Mohamed Morsi did not last long. He was jailed in 2013 after a military coup led by General Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, who is now the president. Some experts on Egyptian politics say the coup undid the revolution, human rights violations, imprisonment of journalists and the unlawful detention of civilians have become routine under the new government. And now, they say, Sisi is not likely to tolerate a real competitor in the upcoming presidential elections. He arrested former Army Chief of Staff Sami Anan after he declared he would run. Shadi Hamid is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution in Washington.
As long as the current regime is in power and isn't willing to kind of open up political space, I think we're going to see a continuation of the status quo, which is high levels of repression. And you have a kind of parliamentary facade. And I think that the upcoming presidential elections, there are no real competitors. That shows that even people who are willing to consider it are being pressured to kind of step aside.
Hamid says the Egyptian parliament has become a rubber stamp for the president, introducing laws that impede freedom of expression and criminalize civic society activities. Sahar Aziz is a professor of law at Rutgers University. She says, in addition to parliament's failures, the Egyptian judiciary is not adhering to the rule of law.
By rule of law, I mean open and fair hearings by unbiased and qualified judges, a degree of predictability and a limitation of arbitrariness of government action, and a level of individual rights and freedoms in accordance with international norms. Mass death sentences, military trials of civilians, and criminalizing youth dissidents do not comport with the rule of law.
Dalia Fahmi is an associate professor of political science at Long Island University. She says the Egyptian military continues its tight grip over political and social life, as well as the media. Under these conditions, she says, it would be very difficult to promote democracy.
From within, is that there has to be a level of political openness. There has to be the ability for citizens to congregate, to form political parties, for there to be a level of political contestation. But more so, there has to be a free and vibrant media.
Fahmy says many regional and international governments have supported Sisi. She says Egypt shows that while Western countries promote democracy in principle, their policies usually reflect their own interests.
The international community really needs to hold repressive regimes accountable. We can't continue this signaling game that we signal one thing to the people and something else to the regime. The new world order is going to have to take human rights, civil liberties, and individual freedoms much more seriously if we're going to talk about real stability in the future.
Shadi Hamid argues that the U.S. administration has shown little public interest in promoting Middle East democracy. Some in the administration of President Donald Trump say security of Egypt and the region is a primary issue. They note threats by Palestinian and Iranian militants as well as Islamic State militants in the Sinai Peninsula. Some advocates of U.S. policy say the administration does indeed support human rights, though it does it so discreetly. Hamid said, if the coming presidential election is an indicator for the future of democracy in Egypt, there is not much to celebrate. Former Prime Minister Ahmed Shafiq, the strongest challenger, recently withdrew from the competition. Critics of the government think he did so under coercion. Shafiq told the press that he had changed his mind after returning home following absence of several years and realizing what progress has been made under President Sisi. Mohammed Al-Shinawi for VOA News, Washington.
The UN Children's Fund is asking for $3.6 billion to support 82 million people, including 48 million children trapped in situations of conflict, natural disasters, and other catastrophic emergencies. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The UN Children's Fund says 84% of the appeal will go to humanitarian crises driven by conflict. The largest portion of the appeal, $1 billion, will support 5.5 million Syrian refugees, half of them children, in neighboring countries. Other major beneficiaries include Yemen, South Sudan, Somalia, Democratic Republic of Congo, Iraq, and Nigeria. UNICEF Deputy Executive Director Omar Abdi says children caught up in war and other disasters are extremely vulnerable to many life-threatening risks.
The impact of war, natural disasters, and climate change continue to force children to flee their homes, trapping them behind conflict lines, and putting them at risk of disease, violence, and exploitation. An increasingly worrying trend is that children in war zones have come under attack at a shocking scale throughout the year.
While bullets and bombs pose a direct threat to children, UNICEF Director of Emergency Programs Manuel Fontaine says more children die from waterborne diseases than from conflict.
We also know that poor quality water is a major driver of malnutrition. This is the usual cycle. That a child drinks poor quality water, gets diarrhea, gets dehydrated, doesn't feed himself or herself, gets malnourished, and then goes into severe malnutrition. So we know that clean water is an extremely important determinant of good nutrition and health.
UNICEF provides more than half of the emergency water, sanitation, and hygiene services in humanitarian crises around the world. That will remain a priority throughout the year. The multi-billion dollar appeal also will be used to support services such as health clinics, vaccination programs, nutrition, emergency education, and psychosocial care. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis, and thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
What's up, Africa? I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington.
And I'm Nadia Sami. Thanks for joining us. We love to have you on board. This is Upfront on the Voice of America.
Listen, we need to discuss what's going on in your communities, issues that affect you.
Are you involved?
Are you engaged in transforming your society?
Today,
right now. This is your platform.
Let us know what you've been up to.
Check us out on Facebook. Drop us a line.
It's Upfront Wednesdays at 1730 UTC
right here on VOA Africa.